2024. This is a podcast about Drupal, PHP, open source, and related software development technologies. I'm Oliver Davis, and tonight I'm here with my guest, Mike Karthauser. Hi, Mike.
Yeah.
How are you?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Ollie.
Great to have you on the show. Can you share a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Okay, so I'm a senior software engineer for a fulfillment company in Bristol called Habu. I have been there for nearly 2 years, and previous to that, spent about 20 odd years self-employed and contracting. So the job I'm currently in is my second paid job since I left uni some decades ago. So a lot of experience about vague stuff, and ultimately sort of self-taught programmer with a graphic design background.
That's interesting. So recently we had Dan Leach on the show as well. Dan and I had a discussion about his talk about PHP 2Es. You were also at the Lightning Talks night giving a talk about testing legacy, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Cool. How did that talk go? It seemed to go quite well from my side of things.
Yeah, I think I approached it with many different options for talks that night, but we'd just finished, or we're working on a big chunk of work relating to, which involved us having to change a piece of code that had been ignored for many years. The fulfillment company I work for, this particular bit of code was to do with order processing. So it was sort of, we essentially were a software company, but we do the whole lot from managing clients' inventories, storing it in our warehouses, and then processing the orders, and kind of packing, picking, and dispatching. So little Amazon, for want of a better comparison, but we've got software in-house, so we're essentially a technology company. This particular task was to do some optimizations, because with our business we get peak time, and peak for us is around about sort of Black Friday and Christmas. So that's typically the time where everything, if it's going to break, it will break then. If we get a lot of orders going through, that will be then. So I decided my talk would be around about that, as it was sort of fresh in my mind.
I think there's one slide in particular I remember seeing, which I think was a snapshot of a little piece of code that I think it used as an example, with things like, you know, lots of nested if statements and other things in it that I can remember seeing at the time. An interesting example. There's a few different definitions I usually find. What's your definition of legacy code? What do you consider to be legacy?
Well, in my experience, I mean, having spent a reasonable time sort of in and out of other people's businesses, the legacy code tends to be what's described as the bit that the business built first to get their business running. Often, it's either written by the business owner, who's now the director and employed loads of devs, or it's outsourced. So often sort of Eastern European software houses, that's where I've generally seen stuff. So in itself is usually, you know, probably, I don't know, half a decade old, maybe not got any test coverage around it, kind of done in a more traditional sort of agency approach of described how functionally it works and then let people kind of get on and do it. And what that generally means is that code comes back into sort of, you know, that there's something important sitting that's running every day that not really anybody's sure about what is going on with it. And more importantly, people don't want to touch it because bad things happen.
Yeah, I think there's definitely that type of thing in all projects, is that little bit of code that nobody wants to touch in case it breaks. There's a quote, I was just trying to see if I could find who put it in, but I remember saying that any code without tests is legacy. I'm not sure if that's common.
Yeah, I think that's it's pretty, it's kind of legacy is kind of like stuff you want to go away, right? That's probably the thing. But in my experience as well, the tendency is people walk around it. Maybe someone's had a go at doing some refactor. In our place particularly, there was changes that had made previous year that had to be rolled back because actually they were done in a way that didn't consider all the use case. And bear in mind, it's like working on a live engine, this is. So you throw something in, you're going to find it break very quickly. And at peak, breaking for us is, API timeouts, database locks, which bad things continue to happen. So yeah, that's what we got. But yeah, we had an interesting role out it to kind of work out ways to do optimization on this, but with the fact that it was on a code base that it didn't it was on Expression Engine, which didn't have PHP unit or a recent version of PHP unit in it, so you couldn't even just go, I'll write some tests and then I'll write some code.
What's your turnaround time? That's whatever you say about writing some code or writing some tests. How long between writing that and then it going into production? Because you said about it being sort of an engine and then problems would appear fairly
Well,
quickly if that was the case. But like, how quick is it something you've got a fairly
we had
comprehensive
we
QA or?
basically had about 3 weeks from when we were presented with the problem to getting it in a state that it could be tested and then deployed. So it was kind of like working back. So what we had ultimately was the task of examining this particular code, identifying some areas that we could improve, and then kind of working out which ones we could do first. So, it's a case of, in an ideal world, we'll do all of this, but actually we, prioritized based on time. So that again presented problems because in the first case, we were just looking at going, right, you saw the screenshot, didn't you? And that was a very small bit. There's a test in Sonar Cloud, which is a code analysis tool, and it gives you cognitive complexity. So it looked at this particular thing, its code, and it was sort of like well over 500, where it kind of recommends you in the under 100, sort of like 50 range for stuff. So we could see that there was stuff that could or would benefit from making it simpler. I mean, it was just difficult to read. And so the problem of difficult to read without test coverage is how do you even know what it's doing? And so if you don't know what it's doing, then how can you change it to do something different if you don't know what it's doing in the first place?
Yeah, definitely. I think I'm not sure I'm getting my terms quite right, but is it the same as is it cyclomatic complexity, where if there's different ifs and else statements or different branches or different ways you could flow through the code? Is that what you're
Yeah,
referring to there?
basically, yeah. So sort of the complexity becomes to do with naming and indentation and just generally like the more if elses return it, that's like bad stuff basically. Well, I mean not say it's bad, but it's just we are in a position where we are able to make bad code better, like that's brilliant. There's still a lot of code probably being written like this code, and it's been operating for its time. So like that's the thing really. You can go into the approach of code writing and making it super clean and squeaky, and but actually the reality is you've got to build something to work first before you can make it work better or refactor. The thing ultimately is whether you are given the time to go back again. If you've worked on stuff via agency or something, usually it's like rush, 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 money's gone, go on to a new thing. And much like working on real engines, like you need maintenance and you need servicing, and you wouldn't think twice about taking a car for a service like once a year or twice a year, but with web, There's a tendency of going, well, that bit works, just let it continue to work.
Yeah, it works. Yeah, so yeah, and actually, there's definitely parts of every code base I think that people don't want to change or touch, even though, like, because it's working, right? Why would we change it? Or maybe we're too scared to change it because we're too worried about breaking something. And I think, as you said, like, how do we test what it does if we don't really know what it does? So, how do you figure out what it does? Because presumably it's working if it's in production, and it's doing the thing it needs to be doing, or is this something that's not working, and then you're going to try and to fix it?
I mean, in this instance, the thing that was different between when it was written and now is that we're throwing way more orders for it, so it's busier. So you can, like, inefficient code when it's not being used very much, doesn't matter what your latency is on database queries, really, or as much. It does, but it doesn't. But when you've got concurrent visits, then it makes a massive difference. Or when you've got a lot of, you've got people. I mean, with our company, like, when an order goes through, someone in the warehouse has to pick the order, right? So there is someone. If our software is slow, people are standing around doing nothing. So that's whereas, when you're doing more sort of web-based client work, you do sort of think about the user at the other side on the browser in their house or on their phone, but it's a lot more abstract because you don't actually know who they are. Whereas, in our place, we can, we've got personas for people, but actually we can use real names because
But
we
they're
can say
actual
that's
people.
being used by Dave or Dan or Chris or whatever, like where they are. And that humanization part of it is, like, that's really good, I think, because you are then going, right, well, I'm solving this problem for X person rather than some arbitrarily 30 to 45 year old of, like that. It's great. Personas are better than nothing, but real people are better than personas.
Yeah, I have a lot of the same things. So my day job is working with Transport for Wales. So yeah, I'm able to do the same sort of thing. I can literally sort of imagine people out there sort of running, obviously running the trains and working at the stations, and when I'm seeing or fixing things like web forms for booking assistance or something, I can sort of think that, obviously we need to fix this because I don't want to think of somebody sit on a platform waiting for assistance, and they're not, because the web form that we built doesn't work or something. There's an actual real life sort of situation rather than something that's more abstract, like you said, than just thinking of a 25 to 35 person, year old person persona or something. So yeah, I think that's, yeah, for some, if you're working in an in-house thing, that's maybe easier to do, or than say compare the working, if you're like with an agency or something, and you're like a level away from that. Yeah, it's always nice to be able to, yeah, actual people. It was better than it's made of arbitrary things. So yeah, how do you, so what approaches have you got then for testing legacy? Because I'd assume that if you're testing, if you're writing new code, then we've got TDD, and we've got the write the test first, then write the test, the code to hit the test pass first. You've got a whole red green refactor loop cycle. But if you've already got code, so you've got legacy code that's there, I just assume that you can't do that because you've already got code, that's the code's already written, so you can't TDD it. So how do you start?
Well, what we, the approach really, I guess, is sort of trying to see what bits you can extract. So, for example, I recall a 7,000 line user model for a financial services company I
What
worked
is the
with a
user
few
model?
years back. Yeah, 7,000 lines it was. And I think it had about 2% code coverage on it, on this class. So I, at that point, was tasked to basically write some additional stuff relating to the user. So at that point, it was just sort of going, right, there's got to be something in there that I can probably extract to a class that is small enough and contained enough that actually I can then write some tests around the behavior of that code that I've extracted. So effectively, getting the parity between your test and your class, getting the coverage for the small bit. And then when you've got a small bit, you've got something to glue another test on. So then at that point, you can sort of approach the, I now need to make this change. With the topic I was referring to in my talk, PHP Southwest, the issue that we had is we couldn't get the test framework on against the same code base because we were limited by, you know, effectively as an old version of there was PHP unit, but it couldn't mock the database. So you can write sort of unit tests, but anything involving database write or, you know, which, you know, essentially we were trying to test a console command. So it was sort of like, where do we put this? The fortunate thing in our position was that we did have access to the database. We knew what the schema was, and fortunately, and that, you know, there had been work with sort of a more modern Laravel app that was using the same database structure. So effectively, we had access to the database. We knew, well, we had a means to run the code, and we had a means to examine the database after the code had run. So effectively, that job swung more around to being like testing an API. So you don't really know what's going on in the middle. We're not getting a response back from it of sorts, but we can do assertions against the database. So I run a thing. I mock up some data. I hit the remote endpoint. It does something. It writes some results, you know, and then we know what we're expecting. So we knew with this code that effectively what we were checking was that any modifications we do meant that it failed in the same way, because we needed to make sure we were only like there was a number of exceptions that it would fail. So for example, if it didn't have prices or there wasn't any quantity for something, you know, like stop didn't exist, or there was no matches on searching or that kind of thing. So we did have a set of things that we could write some tests against. And what we actually did was going, right, well, we've got a whole list of errors. Let's write a small test that returns, that means we can consistently produce any each error. So what that ultimately meant was we could baseline it by how it going, right? We run our test suite. We can guarantee that 11, or no, sorry, 31 different errors are written. And then that gives us a scope to modify or write additional tests to test for success states, because there were some set success states in there. So what we are trying to do is basically cover the, you know, sort of like get the footprint. So make sure we're sort of covering all the code by what we can test. Ultimately, we weren't 100% sure of code coverage because there was no report, but it was kind of like, that was our, does this continue to work? Will this code continue to work? And so that was what the first step in this position was. What that then meant was our next thing was essentially optimizing. So we were like, oh, we want to reduce database load. How can we change, you know, make the code more efficient by caching parts, etc. So it's a case then of sort of like how, you know, sort of checking database load, or we wrote a ticker that meant that we could have a logging going on the machine end. So we were logging to a database. So actually then we can check. So if it's erroring, it's writing exceptions. Are there all the exceptions being thrown? Or, you know, is it writing happy messages when it's doing the right thing? You know, that kind of stuff. So there was a little bit in that respect as well, sort of, you know, just running some diagnostics really off the expression engine side, but also, you know, being able to build out PHP unit work as well.
You doing any particular or specific thing around load testing? So if we mentioned load and concurrency, you run any particular test of like if I make 1,000 or so many requests in a second, what happens? Is that something that you're running as part of this test suite or separately?
Well, we did. We were able to set some sort of like. Well, we the code that we were running were was would you'd hit it and then it would respond after a time. So rather than like pushing something to into a job and just letting it run off a queue, so the runtime with a small amount of data is quite. You don't really get much difference in time for your optimizations. So it was a case of factoring up sort of like 1,000 or 5,000 orders of a similar thing and just basically punching it through and then saying, if I run this with this optimization, this will run quicker. So that was the check. We're also able to check for external calls as well. So it was making network calls across. So yeah, calling across to APIs from, I mean, it's yeah, a bit, what's the word? Fruity. So models making calls out via sort of what's the word? Yeah, models
Little
making
things.
calls out to external APIs, and then like you've got the latency aspect of that as well as it's right into the database. So that is a little bit easier to quantify because basically the difference, like external calls take longer. And the intention rate, yeah, sorry.
Have you looked at or used my PHP bench? Because that's again Dan's benchmarking tool. One of those things built into that. It's like assert that this runs in less than 300 milliseconds or something. Sounds like something might be useful
I
for
think
this.
we've come across it. I mean, this work was being done across the team, so I sort of was more responsible for the structure and testing of the initial work and rather than the actual implementation because we kind of ended up spending a few weeks getting the test suite together. The bit that was more significant really was proving to the business that we were capable to write and change the code without it breaking because there was a lot of reticence, and I guess this is probably across business anyway. Of changing this code is bad. Bad things will happen, and there had been previous examples of bad things happening, like quite bad things happening, which had kind of meant that the appetite for change, and this I think is across the board in general, like we've tested this. Don't do any more code change. You'll break it. Whereas actually, what you want to do is make it simpler so it's more manageable, so that you can. Like good code can be changed at any time. That's the approach.
Yes, good code. Yeah, good code isn't just easy to write; it's easy to change. Be able to do that confidently. So,
Yeah.
how did you go about doing that? Like convincing sort of the business or other people? Like, how did you go about doing that?
What getting the sort of approval, I guess. We basically just we presented our test cases and presented the like the this is what we're you led them along the journey. So that was the thing, quite similar to how I described in my talk. Essentially this is the problem, this is what we've considered, this is evidence, here is more evidence. And we split the work up into very small chunks when we released it. So it was a case of the confidence of if this doesn't go well, we can roll back, right? That's the thing, because the release part is great, but it's having the plan for, disaster planning ultimately. And what we found actually is that once we started releasing, we were doing sort of like daily releases with, watch Datadog in the afternoon to see what the spikes are. And then it was a case then of just being able to evidence that the database had dropped off. And in our place, obviously, we use an AWS, so database traffic dropped means money saved, right? So not only is your code working more efficiently, it's actually saving money compared to when it, like it's quite it was quite noticeable amount of money saved, which gave us a bit more sort of leeway to be able to do the latter releases.
Yeah, but it's building up that momentum then as well. And as one of this episode with Ed Crompton, the earlier episodes, we talked a lot about breaking things down into small chunks and iterating. And for me, I'm much happier doing lots of smaller, more regular releases, and then being able to sort of either quickly fix forward rather than roll back, rather compared to like here's a release with 3 months worth of stuff in or 6 months of stuff in. Much, much happier doing lots of small releases, even though it seems counterintuitive to some people to begin with. Like, you're going to break, you've got more opportunity to break things because you're deploying more often. But it's like, yeah, but that release only had 10 lines or something of change in it, or yeah, or some small amount of change compared to here's one release with thousands of changes in it. Usually they can sort of start to see or sort of justify that to people or change people's sort of initial perspective. And I think, yeah, it's about communication, as you said, and just sort of, what are you doing? Have we thought of X and Y, and then sort of handhold people through it and take them through it. So it's really good that you're in a situation where you can do that. You've got that trust to be able to go and make those sorts of changes. And similarly to like you were saying with the personas versus real people argument, it's if you know that by making this database request X faster, it's going to save that amount of money. You can get really crazy tie what you're doing to an outcome rather than being something more theoretical, that's going to be a good motivator as well.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, obviously, within testing, it's a lot easier to approach testing from the fix a bug approach. But, probably, what you will find is, and we found this when we released, there was a few things that we hadn't considered. But the case then of going, right, well, now we know this has failed a bit different to how we were expecting. So we can either roll it back to a state where we're not getting that error, or just live with it for a little bit and work out what it was that, because I mean, we found with some of this that, where there was areas of the code that weren't even running, because basically it was sort of you would set something and then it would not return, or for like because these conditional statements were so complex that it was very difficult to see where you were actually ending up. It's like, do you end up at the bottom of the, like, you end up at the bottom of the file somehow, but that's, that's a tricky thing. So being able to take that into smaller chunks or start extracting, really, like, your objective is to write as small amount of code as possible, and having the test alongside it is your documentation, and so that then means ultimately we're providing the means for someone else to go in and do it. I'm hoping ultimately that, with this work that we've done, it gives the business more confidence that that piece of code can be changed, and to apply the same technique across the rest of the code base. Because I mean, we've got a good bit of, code that's there. Well, ultimately, the test cases. So, if we were to port it over into our, into a separate application, we've still got the means to run the test suite that we've currently got against that. So, it would be very easy to ensure, even if we were changing language, you could ensure that your code is doing what at least it was doing before. Your tests are your tests are your evidence.
Yeah, you've almost got a case study in a way, like internal case study. Like we've done this once on this bit of code, we can then do the same thing again on a different part or a different service, and carry some credit from having done it all once already.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. It's like having the goodwill. So, if we were to say, oh, we were going to want to do X, you go, well, you did that and it didn't burn the business down. But
Yeah, it's
the guy that the it is obviously it's a tricky thing. I mean, I can see sort of why people would have avoided it, and why you do end up with 7,000 line user class. It didn't start like that. It
Where's the
definitely
user
didn't
class?
start like that. It's just
No.
sort of like, I'm not sure how that works. I'll copy and paste that bit in. And obviously, like the issue with that, you know, having spent a lot of time contracting, is that it's people's engagement with the code that they're writing. You know, like it's the are you just doing enough? Or, you know, like it's that difference between, you know, like if you are tasked to do a small, you know, in the sprint, you've got a couple of objectives to do. Like you can't really justify doing a big refactor. And as time goes on, the big refactor gets bigger and bigger. And, you know, you sort of, I guess it's, you know, it's a blessing and a curse, really, of sort of like working in sort of Scrum, with, you know, that kind of work, in that, you know, you're going from feature to feature, but it's having, you know, having the requirement of having someone there to kind of do servicing, you know, like make sure it 10,000 miles, take it apart, see whether it's, you know, see whether your engine's coked up or whether you need to change things. You know, software, I think, is still in a sort of like state where people, it, you know, you can build it so quick that you can build something quick and it can stay there forever. I mean, I vaguely think I've still got a site which I built like 15, 20 years. Like it, I don't know, I can't remember. Do you know what I mean? It's doing enough, but it certainly would have benefited from refactoring. But the budget that I've got to do it versus a reward, it'd be better off, you know, spinning the disposing of it and setting up, you know, something that someone else has already built that you just need to plug images and text into. You know, don't try and make a snowflake.
Yeah, I think of an example, a project I worked on once. I think it was 2011, because I think Drupal Commerce was released. It was the year Drupal Commerce was released at the DrupalCon London event, and it was for an e-commerce site I was working for an agency for one of their clients, and I had a decision to make: do I do it on this new thing that had just been released, which was Drupal 7 and Drupal Commerce, or do I stick with what I know and do it on Drupal 6 and use Ubercart? I'd used that on a few projects before, built it, and yeah, it was still being used in production until a couple of years ago on Drupal 6, which is, you know, long since been unsupported, but it worked. So yeah, it's like, again, what's the business case, and where's the value in rewriting or moving if it works, other than, of course, you know, there's security updates and implications, but some people just want to it works, let's just carry on with it.
Well, I think that's the thing, isn't it? Of, you know, for the general software buyer, the non-technical, the thing does the thing. You know, does it look the same? You know, there the I found that the people will justify a software change if you can make it cosmetically look different. Like that's more important than it being more like, because, you know, like that's just what's important. So once you've bought it, you'll use it until it's unusable, rather than keep it going, you know. But like I say, there's been so much more better things. You know, if you think, looking back to e-commerce, for example, you know, go back to building an Ubercart or OS Commerce, or previous to that, you know, e-commerce online was very difficult and very expensive, and had to be installed on a server that was expensive to run in a physical site somewhere. So then you need someone else to run it, and, you know, and then you've got things like BigCartel and Shopify and, you know, Squarespace, like, which do brilliant things. It's just that, you know, they've been built for multiple, so it's the sort of volume of people using it makes it cheaper. And then it swings us back around to sort of, I guess, being the what's the word, zero code approaches of, you know, just configuring systems, which, you know, I think is brilliant. That's an amazing thing for web, for that to be so available for people. It just means that people like you and I have to change our skill sets to be able to be, you know, you're managing a project and managing data, as opposed to sort of, you know, writing every line of code, or, you know. But it's that sort of standardization. I mean, I love the fact that, Shopify is so configurable and really easy to get into. But still, you know, there's still an art to being able to get a good site app there. You know, it isn't, you know, like with WordPress, you can have a WordPress site that you can install a ton of plugins on and bad things happen. But you
Yeah,
know,
I
for
don't.
most people using it, it doesn't matter really. You know, like they're doing their business and it's just they treat it the same way as if they were printing a brochure or you know, just that internal, you know, spin up Word, write a document, mail it around the office, you know, that kind of thing. So it's a different, you know, it's a different approach. But when you start getting volume of traffic, like that's where optimization and customization is really important, and that is kind of like where our skills kind of come in really ultimately, you know, like the ability to, you know, you just, I guess it's higher end stuff ultimately.
Yeah, I had a client who you would had a bookstore or something online. They moved their main website onto Shopify a couple of years ago, but I'd also built for them a photography competition that they run. So they just run this for like a couple of weeks a year. People will upload their submissions on, and that's all done with Drupal Commerce. And so essentially, they're placing an order by entering this competition and attaching the photographs to the order, which is their entry. And then there's some custom things that happen behind the scenes then. So we've got people who go in and we'll judge them, assign a score to each one, and we can see then who's judged what and what scores they've given and what the each average is for each score and everything. So they were looking at moving that onto Shopify as well. And I said, well, it will work for your use case of your bookstore because it's the same sort of very typical e-commerce approach. And it would work for the front part of that, but what you won't get then is the custom stuff behind the scenes for all the custom judging panels and everything that I've done. And for them, that's sort of where the value is. And it's it comes to, like you said, like for us, it's about, yeah, what problem are we solving, or what value are we adding? And is if we can do part of it using some sort of no code solution, then yeah, that's ultimately probably better, I think.
Yeah, I think as well is when, like, in that case, you've got is if they've got a fixed budget, it's like, well, yeah, cool. Well, you can save some money by doing the more general stuff using something more general, which then means that we've got more focus on the custom bit. And it also reduces, I mean, okay, you might reduce your budget a bit, but you also have got a smaller problem to solve because you're just solving the technical bit rather than, you know, just doing a migration or managing sort of a fairly generic sort of process. I mean, but any e-commerce stuff where, I mean, when you've had to do things like shipping notifications and install payment gateways and all this kind of stuff, which is risky work ultimately, I think that's what sort of pushed me more towards Drupal in the first place, ultimately, was like when I went from stopping writing custom for everybody to actually going, right, well, this is great. We can use Drupal for most of the sites, you know, install themes. I can get someone who's not particularly savvy at coding, but is good at doing front end to basically skin this stuff up. And then any customization can be done, you know, modular, specifically for the problem that you're trying to solve, you know, just sort of have a little bit of custom, and a lot of, but then bringing round to, you know, where we've, you know, sort of looping back around to the legacy stuff is that by going to a sort of off the shelf, let's say, it gives you the option of doing upgrades with very little risk. And that's ultimately like the most important bit because, and particularly with e-com, like, you know, if you get an exploit, it can cost you your reputation, you know, like all horrible things after 11 o'clock at night, you know, that kind of I've got, you know, store's gone down due to X, you know, whereas I don't worry about security on Shopify because they've got enough devs at their end to worry about that. And
Yeah.
also I've got some what's the word? Assurances via contracts or SLAs with this stuff being broken, and also it being, or the limiting stuff being broken, and also knowing when it will be fixed as well. Like it makes e-commerce way more manageable by just taking out the bit that the devs have got to worry about. I'd rather sell smaller, lots of smaller sites which are less cognitive load than having the big ones that, no one wants to do a 50 grand e-commerce site anymore.
Yeah, I saw a tweet or a LinkedIn post or a X post, whatever it is these days today. And it said it was a screenshot of somebody doing a pull request or a merge request onto a project that it was to do with the amount of code being removed. And I remember seeing it said code to be treated like a liability and not like an asset. So essentially, the less code you've got, the better. So I
Yeah,
think
and
that
I've found
summarizes
that when
the
you
last
find
thing.
yourself writing tests and sort of going, well, actually, that means I can only add I only need to add 2 lines of code, or actually, this case that I've written another test, and I've found it is the code that I've got is already covered by that. I mean, obviously, like there's the issue of I've written a test and it passes. Right, well, I haven't changed anything, so I need to make sure my test is better, because actually my test should fail. But I mean, as a scenario earlier on, we're sort of upgrading a couple of commands on console commands, and the test that I wrote that failed the first time wrote the test to pass it. Second test passed because first test passed, so it was a different scenario, a different scenario. But using the same code, so it was like, well, great. I inadvertently got this working for two cases. I was basically building out from existing tests anyway, so it's sort of, it was good to get that. But the thing with that was going, well, if this test is passing without writing any code, I don't necessarily even need this test anymore. So I'll make my test cases easier to read by having less of them. One thing
That's what
that
was.
we've kind of suffered from, which is when you get smart stuff going on in tests where people start extracting the tests into separate sort of base classes so that you can do import a big bulk importing of data, and then you end up having to sort of read across CSVs to try and work out what was supposed to be going on, which becomes obviously quite complex. But I think the thing is, there's always going to be stuff like that. It's knowing that you could change it, and when is a sensible time to change it. If you can rewrite, if you've got time to do tech debt on test cases, brilliant. Like that's great, because it just makes it easier to read and it helps the next guy. So, we've got quite comprehensive test coverage and sort of API endpoints. So you put a new API endpoint and go, well, if I'm writing CRUD, I can base it off these tests that I've already got. I don't need to think of all the scenarios I am testing because I've already tested similar. So a bit more sort of cookie cutter stuff ultimately, but you get better, I think, at identifying what the change is, but making sure that actually you still are approaching it with tests in mind. And significantly, whilst I am a big fan of TDD, I won't always TDD. It is a case of going, right, maybe you'll start change you'll scratch at the surface a little bit on your code to see what might change, and then quickly support it with tests, rather than going, I can't write a single line of code without testing. Because if you're going into putting a new API endpoint in, for example, you would have find the root, fail, put a new root in. It's that kind of stuff of going, well, I know all of this stuff. Like, clearly, I'm going to need root in and stuff. And so my latter tests are going to cover it. So, why make it more complicated by sort of being really anal? Like,
I've also seen people, spike it out first by write it and then do literally git reset and then wipe it all away and then start TDing it. It's like having had that initial sort of play and now they know more about what they're building, which I thought was quite interesting.
yeah,
And
I tend to might spike it a bit, and then I'll just cut a new branch and go, right, well, I've done this. Particularly, I mean, we're doing a lot with migrations. So going, well, I'll give it a go on here, knowing that this work won't go into production, kind of like a proof of concept, and then I'll write and I'll cut a new branch and then write my test, and then what's the word, cherry pick the files from the code that I've done, or at least compare. And in that respect, like, writing it and throwing away and writing it again means that actually you'll write it more efficiently, because you're kind of doing a refactor. You're having that opportunity to do sort of refactoring as you go on. So that helps. But the good thing in that as well is, you can get a diff against a code base and have a do a load of code and just look at it and go, well, actually, what is it even that's going on there? You know what I mean? Or like, have I touched too much in this PR?
Yes.
All right, well, I'll go back and reset some of it, or I'll make another branch. I mean, I've got multiple branches of the same tickets of stuff. Like more recently, I've been working on, just because it's sort of, you've got to try out. It's like, what's the limits of what we can do? And you are in that position where actually, if it's a bit exploratory, which is classically why people go, well, how do I know? I don't know what I'm, how can I write a test? I don't know what the code's supposed to do. It's like, well, how can you write code if you don't know what the code's supposed to do?
That's a good question. Another good question. Yeah, I think we should get some really interesting stuff. I think we should start wrapping it up
Yeah,
now.
sure.
Do you have any big tips or approaches for if people are working with legacy code? Any big, we've talked quite a lot about testing. We've got any sort of things that you'd recommend people to do?
Well, I think
Legacy.
it's always approach it with the view that you can write a test of some form somehow, right? That it, because where you're going is, my test is providing documentation for me and other people like me, so that they can continue to use this piece of code. So it's not you're writing your test is not just to ship your code, it's helping yourself or your future self. So that's a sort of like initial part. And in that respect, it's like, every bit of code that you're writing goes in a Git commit, and you can do Git blame and see, like it still exists, right? It's going to stay in a code base. So that's the thing of like, oh, well, let's just get something good in there. Also, the approach of, like, you don't need to have 100% code coverage. Write coverage around the tricky bits, if there are tricky bits, and look for where stuff fails. Because, like, sometimes, you might go, well, I'm looking at, there's quite a lot of front end testing frameworks, but I'm not really that worried so much about cosmetics at this point. Having spent a long time in web working for agency and doing front end, it's, way more people were more worried about what pixel perfect is. But from our point, and you said like your Transport for Wales stuff, like, it's, there's a human using this, so make it easy for the human, like, have that in mind, but also, like I say, just it's just looking at what you've got. Is there a way to change this? Sometimes you might go, well, I'll have a think. I've got to just get this change in without the code coverage. Like, just pragmatic. Ultimately, thing is on fire, put fire out. But if you're good at it, you become better at reproducing. I said about the tests, the testing bugs. Testing bugs are brilliant, because someone reports a problem, you write a test to prove you can reproduce that problem, and then you change your code to, or you change your test to then provide the correct outcome, which will fail. Second test, and then write your second test, write your code to make your second test pass, and then you can either invert your first test to find error doesn't exist, which is similar behavior, but it then you can be 100% confident that your change is going to fix the thing that was reported. It may cause some other problem, but if your code coverage is good and you are responsive with that, you know, like, how do I know this is working or not? You know, what are you know, did my release go out? And then, as you say, it's a case of rolling back to a known state or making some forward change to get the known state that you want as well. But
The
yeah.
test, you know when you're done, because
Yeah,
it
I mean
passes.
that's it. I in a very brief sort of a nutshell, it is a case of, you know, approaching the work of how do I know when I'm done, right? That's the, you know, that is the essence of you know, here, make sure the task is clearly defined at the start in a way that you know when you're done. That's, you know, that's a simple thing. Otherwise, you're just, you know, what's the word? You can over optimize or refactor for no benefit. And, you know, if you were your boss paying you for doing this, I'm sure they'd rather you do a good job in 2 hours than doing it in 2 weeks.
Yeah, I feel like there's another tangent we could go off then about how do you make sure you've got good acceptance criteria, and how do you know like you've got all your user stories written in a good way, you've got all those sort of ex test cases sort of described up front. But yeah, we'd have a whole other another episode of that if we go down that route.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, in that case, it's a case of containing your code into small enough chunks so that it's very clear that you have got your test case is for there. But you know, that's a whole, as you say, a whole world of pre-planning, and more time you can spend up front with acceptance criteria or knowing what the next bit, you know, so you can basically pivot onto the next bit of code that you're writing. You know, if you've got another user, you need to consider make it easy to add that onto the existing users that you're currently considering.
Other than at PHP Southwest, where can people find you usually online? Is there somewhere that people got questions they can ask, in touch with you?
I have been a long, I got into using Twitter a long time ago and then got out of using Twitter a long time ago as well. But ultimately, I mean, I'm available. I'm on LinkedIn, to be honest. Find me Mike.Karthauser at LinkedIn. That's probably the easiest place to find me. I have a very small single page website with a contact on for a company, my sort of sole trade company, which is Automica Labs. So that's at automica.io, AUTOMICA, sort of .io. And yeah, either of those or on the meetups, or you know, find me first name, last name at habu.com.
We'll put a link to all those things in the episode notes as well. But thanks for joining me today, and I'll look
Yeah.
forward to seeing you at PHP South next PHP Southwest next week.
Yeah, thanks, Ollie. Good to
Thanks
speak
everyone
to you
for
too.
listening.
Yeah,
Speak
cheers.
to the Beyond Blocks podcast. I'm Oliver Davis. Thank you very much.